right. But of course he didn't. I'd like to hear about it, he said. Aaron was caught in the roil of change, too. But his impulses were more sluggish than Cal's. His body didn't scream at him so shrilly. His passions took a religious direction. He decided on the ministry for his future. He attended all services in the Episcopal Church, helped with the flowers and leaves at feast times, and spent many hours with the young and curly-headed clergyman, Mr. Rolfe. Aaron's training in worldliness was gained from a young man of no experience, which gave him the ability for generalization only the inexperienced can have. Aaron was confirmed in the Episcopal Church and took his place in the choir on Sundays. Abra followed him. Her feminine mind knew that such things were necessary but unimportant. It was natural that the convert Aaron should work on Cal. First, Aaron prayed silently for Cal, but finally he approached him. He denounced Cal's godlessness, demanded his reformation. Cal might have tried to go along if his brother had been more clever. But Aaron had reached a point of passionate purity that made everyone else foul. After a few lectures, Cal found him unbearably smug and told him so. It was a relief to both of them when Aaron abandoned his brother to eternal damnation. Aaron's religion inevitably took a sexual turn. He spoke to Abra of the necessity for abstinence and decided that he would live a life of celibacy. Abra, in her wisdom, agreed with him, feeling and hoping that this phase would pass. Celibacy was the only state she had known. She wanted to marry Aaron and bear any number of his children, but for the time being she didn't speak of it. She had never been jealous before, but now she began to find in herself an instinctive and perhaps justified hatred of the Reverend Mr. Rolfe. Cal watched his brother triumph over sins he had never committed. He thought sardonically of telling him about his mother, to see how he would handle it, but he withdrew the thought quickly. He didn't think Aaron could handle it at all. Chapter 39. At intervals, Selina suffered from a mild eructation of morality. The process never varied much. One burst was like another. Sometimes it started in the pulpit, and sometimes with a new ambitious president of the Women's Civic Club. Gambling was invariably the sin to be eradicated. There were certain advantages in attacking gambling. One could discuss it, which wasn't true of prostitution. It was an obvious evil, and most of the games were operated by Chinese. There was little chance of treading on the toes of a relative. From church and club, the town's two newspapers caught fire. Editorials demanded a cleanup. The police agreed, but pleaded shorthandedness and tried for increased budget and sometimes succeeded. When it got to the editorial stage, everyone knew the cards were down. What followed was as carefully produced as a ballet. The police got ready, the gambling houses got ready, and the papers set up congratulatory editorials in advance. Then came the raid, deliberate and sure. 20 or more Chinese, imported from Pajaro, a few bums, 6 or 8 drummers, who, being strangers, weren't warned, fell into the police net, were booked, jailed, and in the morning fined and released. The town relaxed in its new spotlessness, and the houses lost only one night of business plus the fines. It is one of the triumphs of the human that he can know a thing and still not believe it. In the fall of 1916, Cal was watching the Fantan game at Shorty Lim's one night when the raid scooped him up. In the dark, no one noticed him, and the chief was embarrassed to find him in the tank in the morning. The chief telephoned Adam, got him up from his breakfast. Adam walked the 2 blocks to the city hall, picked up Cal, crossed the street to the post office for his mail, and then the two walked home. Lee had kept Adam's eggs warm and had fried 2 for Cal. Aaron walked through the dining room on his way to school. "Want me to wait for you?" he asked Cal. No, said Cal. He kept his eyes down and ate his eggs. Adam hadn't spoken, except to say, come along, at the city hall after he had thanked the chief. Cal gulped down a breakfast he didn't want, darting glances up through his eyelashes at his father's face. He could make nothing of Adam's expression. It seemed at once puzzled and angry and thoughtful and sad. Adam stared down into his coffee cup. The silence grew until it had the weight of age so hard to lift aside. Lee looked in. Coffee? He asked. Adam shook his head slowly. Lee withdrew and this time closed the kitchen door. In the clock-ticking silence, Cal began to be afraid. He felt a strength flowing out of his father he had never known was there. Itching prickles of agony ran up his legs, and he was afraid to move to restore the circulation. He knocked his fork against his plate to make a noise, and the clatter was swallowed up. The clock struck 9 deliberate strokes, and they were swallowed up. As the fear began to chill, resentment took its place. So might a trapped fox feel anger at the paw which held him to the trap. Suddenly Cal jumped up. He hadn't known he was going to move. He shouted, and he hadn't known he was going to speak. He cried, "Do what you're going to do to me! Go ahead! Get it over!" And his shout was sucked into the silence. Adam slowly raised his head. It's true that Cal had never looked into his father's eyes before. And it's true that many people never look into their father's eyes. Adam's irises were light blue, with dark radial lines leading into the vortices of his pupils. And deep down in each pupil, Cal saw his own face reflected, as though 2 Cals looked out at him. Adam said slowly, "I've failed you, haven't I?" It was worse than an attack. Cal faltered. "What do you mean?" "You were picked up in a gambling house. I don't know how you got there, what you were doing there, why you went there." Cal sat limply down and looked at his plate. "Do you gamble, son?" "No, sir. I was just watching." "Had you been there before?" "Yes, sir, many times." "Why do you go?" "I don't know. I get restless at night. Like an alley cat, I guess." He thought of Kate, and his weak joke seemed horrible to him. "When I can't sleep, I walk around," he said, "to try to blot it out." Adam considered his words, inspected each one. "Does your brother walk around, too?" "Oh, no, sir. He wouldn't think of it. He's not restless." "You see, I don't know," said Adam. "I don't know anything about you." Cal wanted to throw his arms about his father, to hug him and to be hugged by him. He wanted some wild demonstration of sympathy and love. He picked up his wooden napkin ring and thrust his forefinger through it. "I'd tell you if you asked," he said softly. "I didn't ask. I didn't ask. I'm as bad a father as my father was." Cal had never heard this tone in Adam's voice. It was hoarse and breaking with warmth, and he fumbled among his words, feeling for them in the dark. "My father made a mold and forced me into it," Adam said. "I was a bad casting, but I couldn't be remelted. Nobody can be remelted, so I remained a bad casting." Cal said, "Sir, don't be sorry. You've had too much of that." "Have I? Maybe. But maybe the wrong kind. I don't know my sons. I wonder whether I could learn." "I'll tell you anything you want to know. Just ask me." "Where would I start? Right at the beginning? Are you sad or mad because I was in jail?" To Cal's surprise, Adam laughed. "You were just there, weren't you? You didn't do anything wrong." "Maybe being there was wrong." Cal wanted a blame for himself. One time I was just there, said Adam. I was a prisoner for nearly a year for just being there. Cal tried to absorb this heresy.
I don't believe it, he said.
Sometimes I don't either. But I know that when I escaped, I robbed a store and stole some clothes.
I don't believe it,
Cal said weakly. But the warmth, the closeness, was so delicious that he clung to it. He breathed shallowly so that the warmth might not be disturbed. Adam said, Do you remember Samuel Hamilton?
Sure you do.
When you were a baby, he told me I was a bad father. He hit me and knocked me down to impress it on me.
That old man?
He was a tough old man. And now I know what he meant. I'm the same as my father was. He didn't allow me to be a person. And I haven't seen my sons as people. That's what Samuel meant.
He looked right into Cal's eyes and smiled. And Cal ached with affection for him. Cal said,
We don't think you're a bad father.
Poor things, said Adam. How would you know? You've never had any other kind.
I'm glad I was in jail, said Cal.
So am I. So am I, he laughed. We've both been in jail. We can talk together.
A gaiety grew in him.
Maybe you can tell me what kind of a boy you are, can't you?
Yes, sir.
Will you?
Yes, sir.
Well, tell me. You see, there's a responsibility in being a person. It's more than just taking up space where air would be. What are you like?
No joke?
Cal asked shyly.
No joke. Oh, surely no joke. Tell me about yourself. That is, if you want to.
Cal began.
Well, I'm...
He stopped.
It's not so easy when you try, he said.
I guess it would be... Maybe impossible. Tell me about your brother.
What do you want to know about him?
What you think of him, I guess. That's all you could tell me.
Cal said,
He's good. He doesn't do bad things. He doesn't think bad things.
Now you're telling about yourself.
Sir?
You're saying you do and think bad things.
Cal's cheeks reddened.
Well, I do.
Very bad things?
Yes, sir.
Do you want me to tell?
No, Cal. You've told. Your voice tells and your eyes tell you're at war with yourself. But you shouldn't be ashamed. It's awful to be ashamed.
Is Aaron ever ashamed?
He doesn't do anything to be ashamed of.
Adam leaned forward.
Are you sure?
Pretty sure.
Tell me, Cal, do you protect him?
How do you mean, sir?
I mean like this. If you heard something bad or cruel or ugly, would you keep it from him?
I think so.
You think he's too weak to bear things you can bear?
It's not that, sir. He's good. He's really good. He never does anyone harm. He never says bad things about anyone. He's not mean, and he never complains, and he's brave. He doesn't like to fight, but he will.
You love your brother, don't you?
Yes, sir. And I do bad things to him. I cheat him, and I fool him. Sometimes I hurt him for no reason at all.
And then you're miserable.
Yes, sir.
Is Aaron ever miserable?
I don't know. When I didn't want to join the church, he felt bad. And once when Abra got angry and said she hated him, he felt awful bad. He was sick. He had a fever. Don't you remember? Lee sent for the doctor.
Adam said with wonder, I could live with you and not know any of these things.
Why was Abra mad?
Cal said,
I don't know if I ought to tell.
I don't want you to, then.
It's nothing bad. I guess it's all right. You see, Sir Aaron wants to be a minister. Mr. Rolfe, well, he likes high church, and Aaron liked that. and he thought maybe he would never get married and maybe go to a retreat.
Like a monk, you mean?
Yes, sir.
And Abra didn't like that.
Like it? She got spitting mad. She can get mad sometimes. She took Aaron's fountain pen and threw it on the sidewalk and tramped on it. She said she'd wasted half her life on Aaron.
Adam laughed.
How old is Abra?
Nearly 15. But she's, well, more than that some ways.
I should say she is.
But what did Aaron do? He just got quiet, but he felt awful bad.
Adam said, I guess you could have taken her away from him then.
Abra is Aaron's girl, said Cal.
Adam looked deeply into Cal's eyes. Then he called,
Lee?
There was no answer.
Lee,
he called again. He said, I didn't hear him go out. I want some fresh coffee. Cal jumped up.
I'll make it.
Say, said Adam, you should be in school.
I don't want to go.
You ought to go. Aaron went.
I'm happy, Cal said. I want to be with you.
Adam looked down at his hands.
Make the coffee,
he said softly, and his voice was shy. When Cal was in the kitchen, Adam looked inward at himself with wonder. His nerves and muscles throbbed with an excited hunger. His fingers yearned to grasp, his legs to run. His eyes avidly brought the room into focus. He saw the chairs, the pictures, the red roses on the carpet, and new sharp things, almost people things, but friendly things. And then his brain was born sharp appetite for the future, a pleased, warm anticipation, as though the coming minutes and weeks must bring delight. He felt a dawn emotion, with a lovely day to slip golden and quiet over him. He laced his fingers behind his head and stretched his legs out stiff. In the kitchen, Cal urged on the water heating in the coffee pot, and yet he was pleased to be waiting. A miracle, once it is familiar, is no longer a miracle. Cal had lost his wonder at the golden relationship with his father, but the pleasure remained. The poison of loneliness and the gnawing envy of the unlonely had gone out of him, and his person was clean and sweet, and he knew it was. He dredged up an old hatred to test himself, and he found the hatred gone. He wanted to serve his father, to give him some great gift, to perform some huge good task in honor of his father. The coffee boiled over, and Cal spent minutes cleaning up the stove. He said to himself, I wouldn't have done this yesterday. Adam smiled at him when he carried in the steaming pot. Adam sniffed and said, That's a smell could raise me out of a concrete grave.
It boiled over, said Cal.
It has to boil over to taste good, Adam said. I wonder where Lee went.
Maybe in his room. Shall I look?
No, he'd have answered.
Sir, when I finish school, will you let me run the ranch?
You're planning early. How about Aaron?
He wants to go to college. Don't tell him I told you. Let him tell you, and you'll be surprised.
Why, that's fine, said Adam. But don't you want to go to college, too?
I bet I could make money on the ranch, enough to pay Aaron's way through college.
Adam sipped his coffee.
That's a generous thing, he said. I don't know whether I ought to tell you this, but... Well, when I asked you earlier what kind of boy Aaron was, you defended him so badly, I thought you might dislike him or even hate him.
I have hated him, Cal said vehemently, and I've hurt him, too. But, sir, can I tell you something? I don't hate him now. I won't ever hate him again. I don't think I will hate anyone, not even my mother.
He stopped, astonished at his slip, and his mind froze up tight and helpless. Adam looked straight ahead. He rubbed his forehead with the palm of his hand. Finally, he said quietly, You know about your mother.
It wasn't a question.
Yes. Yes, sir.
All about her?
Yes, sir.
Adam leaned back in his chair. Does Aaron know?
Oh, no. No, no, sir. He doesn't know.
Why do you say it that way?
I wouldn't dare to tell him.
Why not?
Cal said brokenly.
I don't think he could stand it. He hasn't enough badness in him to stand it.
He wanted to continue, any more than you could, sir. But he left the last unsaid.
Adam's face looked weary. He moved his head from side to side. Cal, listen to me. Do you think there's any chance of keeping Aaron from knowing? Think carefully.
Cal said, he doesn't go near places like that. He's not like me.
Suppose someone told him.
I don't think he'd believe it, sir. I think he'd lick whoever told him and think it was a lie.
You've been there?
Yes, sir. I had to know.
And Cal went on excitedly.
If you went away to college and never lived in this town again...
Adam nodded.
Yes, that might be. But he has 2 more years here.
Maybe I could make him hurry it up and finish in 1 year. He's smart.
But you're smarter.
A different kind of smart, said Cal.
Adam seemed to grow until he filled one side of the room. His face was stern and his blue eyes sharp and penetrating.
Cal, he said harshly.
Sir?
I trust you, son, said Adam.
Adam's recognition brought a ferment of happiness to Cal. He walked on the balls of his feet. He smiled more often than he frowned, and the secret darkness was seldom on him. Lee, noticing the change in him, asked quietly,
You haven't found a girl, have you?
Girl? No. Who wants a girl?
Everybody, said Lee. And Lee asked Adam, Do you know what's got into Cal?
Adam said,
He knows about her.
Does he?
Lee stayed out of trouble.
Well, you remember, I thought you should have told him.
I didn't tell him. He knew.
What do you think of that? Said Lee.
But that's not information to make a boy hum when he studies and play catch with his cap when he walks.
How about Aaron?
I'm afraid of that, said Adam. I don't think I want him to know.
It might be too late.
I might have a talk with Aaron, kind of feel around, Lee considered.
Something's happened to you, too.
Has it?
I guess it has, said Adam.
But humming and sailing his cap, driving quickly through his schoolwork, were only the smallest of Cal's activities. In his new joy, he appointed himself guardian of his father's content. It was true what he had said about not feeling hatred for his mother, but that didn't change the fact that she had been the instrument of Adam's hurt and shame. Cal reasoned that what she could do before, she could do again. He set himself to learn all he could about her. A known enemy is less dangerous, less able to surprise. At night, he was drawn to the house across the tracks. Sometimes in the afternoon, he lay hidden in the tall weeds across the street, watching the place. He saw the girls come out, dressed somberly, even severely. They left the house always in pairs, and Cal followed them with his eyes to the corner of Castroville Street, where they turned left toward Main Street. He discovered that if you didn't know where they had come from, you couldn't tell what they were. But he wasn't waiting for the girls to come out. He wanted to see his mother in the light of day. He found that Kate emerged every Monday at 1:30. Cal made arrangements in school by doing extra and excellent work to make up for his absences on Monday afternoons. To Aaron's questions, he replied that he was working on a surprise and was duty-bound to tell no one. Aaron wasn't much interested anyway. In his self-immersion, Aaron soon forgot the whole thing. Cal,
after he had followed Kate several times, knew her route. She always went to the same places. First to the Monterey County Bank, where she was admitted behind the shining bars that defended the safe deposit vault. She spent 15 or 20 minutes there. Then she moved slowly along Main Street, looking in the store windows. She stepped into Porter and Irvin's and looked at dresses and sometimes made a purchase. Elastic, safety pins, a veil, a pair of gloves. About 2:15, she entered Minnie Franken's beauty parlor, stayed an hour, and came out with her hair pinned up in tight curls and a silk scarf around her head and tied under her chin. At 3:30, she climbed the stairs to the offices over the farmer's mercantile and went into the consulting room of Dr. Rosen. When she came down from the doctor's office, she stopped for a moment at Bell's candy store and bought a 2-pound box of mixed chocolates. She never varied the route. From Bell's, she went directly back to Castroville Street and thence to her house. There was nothing strange about her clothing. She dressed exactly like any well-to-do Salinas woman out shopping on a Monday afternoon, except that she always wore gloves, which was unusual for Salinas. The gloves made her hands seem puffed and pudgy. She moved as though she were surrounded by a glass shell. She spoke to no one and seemed to see no one. Occasionally a man turned and looked after her and then nervously went about his business. But for the most part she slipped past like an invisible woman. For a number of weeks Cal followed Kate. He tried not to attract her attention. And since Kate walked always looking straight ahead, he was convinced that she didn't notice him. When Kate entered her own yard, Cal strolled casually by and went home by another route. He couldn't have said exactly why he followed her, except that he wanted to know all about her. The 8th week he took the route, she completed her journey and went into her overgrown yard as usual. Cal waited a moment and then strolled past the rickety gate. Kate was standing behind a tall, ragged privet. She said to him coldly, "What do you want?" Cal froze in his steps. He was suspended in time, barely breathing. Then he began a practice he had learned when he was very young. He observed and catalogued details outside his main object. He noticed how the wind from the south bent over the new little leaves of the tall privet bush. He saw the muddy path beaten to black mush by many feet, and Kate's feet standing far to the side of the mud. He heard a switch engine in the Southern Pacific yards discharging steam in shrill, dry spurts. He felt the chill air on the growing fuzz on his cheeks. And all the time he was staring at Kate, and she was staring back at him. And he saw in the set and color of her eyes and hair, even in the way she held her shoulders high in a kind of semi-shrug, that Aaron looked very like her. He didn't know his own face well enough to recognize her mouth and little teeth and wide cheekbones as his own. They stood thus for the moment between two gusts of the southern wind. Kate said, "This isn't the first time you've followed me. What do you want?" He dipped his head. "Nothing," he said. "Who told you to do it?" she demanded.
"Nobody, ma'am."
"You won't tell me, will you?"
Cal heard his own next speech with amazement. It was out before he could stop it.
"You're my mother, and I wanted to see what you're like."
It was the exact truth, and it had leaped out like the stroke of a snake.
"What? What is this? Who are you?"
"I'm Cal Trask," he said. He felt the delicate change of balance as when a seesaw moves. His was the upper seat now. Although her expression hadn't changed, Cal knew she was on the defensive. She looked at him closely, observed every feature. A dim, remembered picture of Charles leaped into her mind. Suddenly she said, "Come with me." She turned and walked up the path, keeping well to the side, out of the mud. Cal hesitated only for a moment before following her up the steps. He remembered the big, dim room, but the rest was strange to him. Kate preceded him down a hall and into a room. As she went past the kitchen entrance, she called,
tea, 2 cups.
In her room, she seemed to have forgotten him. She removed her coat, tugging at the sleeves with reluctant, fat, gloved fingers. Then she went to a new door cut in the wall in the end of the room where her bed stood. She opened the door and went into a new little lean-to.
"Come in here," she said. "Bring that chair with you."
He followed her into a box of a room. It had no windows, no decorations of any kind. Its walls were painted a dark gray. A solid gray carpet covered the floor. The only furniture in the room was a huge chair, puffed with gray silk cushions, a tilted reading table, and a floor lamp deeply hooded. Kate pulled the light chain with her gloved hand, holding it deep in the crotch between her thumb and forefinger as though her hand were artificial.
"Close the door," Kate said.
The light threw a circle on the reading table and only diffused dimly through the gray room. Indeed, the gray walls seemed to suck up the light and destroy it. Kate settled herself gingerly among the thick down cushions and slowly removed her gloves. The fingers of both hands were bandaged. Kate said angrily,
"Don't stare. It's arthritis." "Oh, so you want to see, do you?"
She unwrapped the oily-looking bandage from her right forefinger and stuck the crooked finger under the light.
"There, look at it," she said. "It's arthritis."
She whined in pain as she tenderly wrapped the bandage loosely.
"God, those gloves hurt," she said. "Sit down."
Cal crouched on the edge of his chair.
"You'll probably get it," Kate said. "My great aunt had it, and my mother was just beginning to get it."
She stopped. The room was very silent. There was a soft knock on the door. Kate called,
"Is that you, Joe? Set the tray down out there. Joe, are you there?"
A mutter came through the door. Kate said tonelessly,
"There's a litter in the parlor. Clean it up. Anne hasn't cleaned her room. Give her one more warning. Tell her it's the last. Eva got smart last night. Take care of her. And Joe, tell the cook if he serves carrots again this week, he can pack up. Hear me?"
The mutter came through the door.
"That's all,"
said Kate.
"The dirty pigs," she muttered. "They'd rot if I didn't watch them. Go out and bring in the tea tray."
The bedroom was empty when Cal opened the door. He carried the tray into the lean-to and set it gingerly on the tilted reading table. It was a large silver tray, and on it were a pewter teapot, 2 paper-thin white teacups, sugar cream, and an open box of chocolates.
"Pour the tea," said Kate. "It hurts my hands."
She put a chocolate in her mouth.
"I saw you looking at this room,"
she went on when she had swallowed her candy.
"The light hurts my eyes. I come in here to rest."
She saw Cal's quick glance at her eyes and said with finality,
"The light hurts my eyes."
She said harshly,
"What's the matter? Don't you want tea?"
"No, ma'am," said Cal. "I don't like tea."
She held the thin cup with her bandaged fingers.
"All right, what do you want?"
"Nothing, ma'am."
"Just wanted to look at me?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"Are you satisfied?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"How do I look?"
She smiled crookedly at him and showed her sharp white little teeth.
"All right. I might have known you'd cover up. Where's your brother?"
"In school, I guess, or home."
"What's he like?"
"He looks more like you."
"Oh, he does? Well, is he like me?"
"He wants to be a minister," said Cal.
"I guess that's the way it should be. Looks like me and wants to go into the church. A man can do a lot of damage in the church. When someone comes here, he's got his guard up. But in a church, a man's wide open."
"He means it," said Cal.
She leaned toward him, and her face was alive with interest.
"Fill my cup. Is your brother dull?"
"He's nice," said Cal.
"I asked you if he's dull."
"No, ma'am," said Cal.
She settled back and lifted her cup. How's your father?
I don't want to talk about him, Cal said.
Oh, no. You like him, then?
I love him, said Cal.
Kate peered closely at him, and a curious spasm shook her. An aching twist rose on her chest, and then she closed up and her control came back.
Don't you want some candy?
She asked.
Yes, ma'am.
Why did you do it?
Why did I do what?
Why did you shoot my father and run away from us?
Did he tell you that?
No, he didn't tell us. She touched one hand with the other, and her hands leaped apart as though the contact burned them. She asked, Does your father ever have any girls or young women come to your house?
No, said Cal. Why did you shoot him and go away?
Her cheeks tightened and her mouth straightened, as though a net of muscles took control. She raised her head, and her eyes were cold and shallow.
You talk older than your age, she said, but you don't talk old enough. Maybe you'd better run along and play and wipe your nose.
Sometimes I work my brother over, he said. I make him squirm. I've made him cry. He doesn't know how I do it. I'm smarter than he is. I don't want to do it. It makes me sick. Kate picked it up as though it were her own conversation. They thought they were so smart, she said. They looked at me and thought they knew about me. And I fooled them. I fooled every one of them. And when they thought they could tell me what to do, oh, that's when I fooled them best. Charles, I really fooled them then.
My name is Caleb, Cal said.
Caleb got to the Promised Land. That's what Lee says, and it's in the Bible.
That's the Chinaman, Kate said, and she went on eagerly. Adam thought he had me. When I was hurt, all broken up, he took me in and he waited on me, cooked for me. He tried to tie me down that way. Most people get tied down that way. They're grateful, they're in debt, and that's the worst kind of handcuffs. But nobody can hold me. I waited and waited until I was strong, and then I broke out. Nobody can trap me, she said. I knew what he was doing. I waited.
The gray room was silent except for her excited, wheezing breath. Cal said,
Why did you shoot him?
Because he tried to stop me. I could have killed him, but I didn't. I just wanted him to let me go.
Did you ever wish you'd stayed?
Christ, no. Even when I was a little girl, I could do anything I wanted. They never knew how I did it. Never. They were always so sure they were right. And they never knew. No one ever knew. A kind of realization came to her.
Sure, you're my kind. Maybe you're the same. Why wouldn't you be?
Cal stood up and clasped his hands behind his back. He said,
When you were little, did you...
He paused to get the thought straight.
Did you ever have the feeling like you were missing something? Like as if the others knew something you didn't? Like a secret they wouldn't tell you? Did you ever feel that way?
While he spoke, her face began to close against him. And by the time he paused, she was cut off, and the open way between them was blocked. She said,
What am I doing, talking to kids?
Cal unclasped his hands from behind him and shoved them in his pockets.
Talking to snot-nosed kids, she said. I must be crazy.
Cal's face was alight with excitement, and his eyes were wide with vision. Kate said, What's the matter with you? He stood still, his forehead glistening with sweat, his hands clenched into fists. Kate, as she had always, drove in the smart but senseless knife of her cruelty. She laughed softly.
I may have given you some interesting things. Like this.
She held up her crooked hands.
But if it's epilepsy, fits, you didn't get it from me.
She glanced brightly up at him, anticipating the shock and beginning worry in him. Cal spoke happily.
I'm going, he said. I'm going now. It's all right. What Lee said was true.
What did Lee say?
Cal said, I was afraid I had you in me.
You have, said Kate.
No, I haven't. I'm my own. I don't have to be you.
How do you know that? She demanded.
I just know. It just came to me whole. If I'm mean, it's my own mean.
This Chinaman has really fed you some pap. What are you looking at me like that for?
Cal said. I don't think the light hurts your eyes. I think you're afraid.
Get out, she cried. Go on, get out.
I'm going.
He had his hand on the doorknob.
I don't hate you, he said. But I'm glad you're afraid.
She tried to shout, Joe, but her voice thickened to a croak. Cal wrenched open the door and slammed it behind him. Joe was talking to one of the girls in the parlor. They heard the stutter of light, quick footsteps. But by the time they looked up, a streaking figure had reached the door, opened it, slipped through, and the heavy front door banged. There was only one step on the porch, and then a crunch as jumping feet struck earth.
What in hell was that? The girl asked.
God knows, said Joe. Sometimes I think I'm seeing things.
Me too, said the girl. Did I tell you? Clara's got bugs under her skin.
I guess she's seen the shadow of the needle, said Joe. Well, the way I figure, the less you know, the better off you are.
That's the truth you said there, the girl agreed.
Chapter 40. Kate sat back in her chair against the deep down cushions. Waves of nerves cruised over her body, raising little hairs and making ridges of icy burn as they went. She spoke softly to herself.
Steady now, she said. Quiet down. Don't let it hit you. Don't think for a while. The goddamn snot-nose.
She thought suddenly of the only person who had ever made her feel this panic hatred. It was Samuel Hamilton, with his white beard and his pink cheeks and the laughing eyes that lifted her skin and looked underneath. With her bandaged forefinger, she dug out a slender chain which hung around her neck and pulled the chain's burden up from her bodice. On the chain was strung two safe deposit keys, a gold watch with a fleur-de-lis pin, and a little steel tube with a ring on its top. Very carefully, she unscrewed the top from the tube and, spreading her knees, shook out the gelatin capsule. She held the capsule under the light and saw the white crystals inside. 6 grains of morphine, a good, sure margin. Very gently, she eased the capsule into its tube, screwed on the cap, and dropped the chain inside her dress. Cal's last words had been repeating themselves over and over in her head. I think you're afraid. She said the words aloud to herself to kill the sound. The rhythm stopped, but a strong picture formed in her mind, and she let it form so she could inspect it again. It was before the lean-to was built. Kate had collected the money Charles had left. The check was converted to large bills, and the bills in their bales were in the safe deposit box at the Monterey County Bank. It was about the time the first pains began to twist her hands. There was enough money now to go away. It was just a matter of getting the most she could out of the house. But also it was better to wait until she felt quite well again. She never felt quite well again. New York seemed cold and very far away. A letter came to her signed Ethel. Who in hell was Ethel? Whoever she was, she must be crazy to ask for money. Ethel. There were hundreds of Ethels. Ethels grew on every bush, and this one scrawled illegibly on a lined pad. Not very long afterward, Ethel came to see Kate, and Kate hardly recognized her. Kate sat at her desk, watchful, suspicious, and confident. It's been a long time, she said. Ethel responded like a soldier who comes in his cushion age upon the sergeant who trained him.
I've been poorly, she said.
Her flesh had thickened and grown heavy all over her. Her clothes had the strained cleanliness that means poverty. "Where are you staying now?" Kate asked, and she wondered how soon the old bag would be able to come to her point.
"Southern Pacific Hotel. I got a room."
"Oh, then you don't work in a house now."
"I couldn't never get started again," said Ethel. "You shouldn't have run me off."
She wiped big tears from the corners of her eyes with the tip of a cotton glove.
"Things are bad," she said. "First I had trouble when we got that new judge. 90 days. And I didn't have no record. Not here, anyways. I come out of that and I got the old Joe. I didn't know I had it. Give it to a regular. Nice fella, worked on the section gang. He got sore and busted me up, hurt my nose, lost 4 teeth. And that new judge, he gave me 180. Hell, Kate, you lose all your contacts in 180 days. They forget you're alive. I just never could get started."
Kate nodded her head in cold and shallow sympathy. She knew that Ethel was working up to the bite. Just before it came, Kate made a move. She opened her desk drawer and took out some money and held it out to Ethel. "I never let a friend down," she said. "Why don't you go to a new town, start fresh? It might change your luck." Ethel tried to keep her fingers from grabbing at the money. She fanned the bills like a poker hand. 4 tens. Her mouth began to work with emotion. Ethel said, "I kind of hoped you'd see your way to let me take more than $40.
"What do you mean?"
"Didn't you get my letter?"
"What letter?"
"Oh," said Ethel.
"Well, maybe it got lost in the mail. They don't take no care of things. Anyways, I thought you might look after me. I don't feel good hardly ever. Got a kind of weight dragging my guts down."
She sighed, and then she spoke so rapidly that Kate knew it had been rehearsed.
"Well, maybe you remember how I've got, like, second sight," Ethel began. "Always predicting things that come true, always dreaming stuff and it come out. Fella says I should go in the business, says I'm a natural medium. You remember that?"
"No," said Kate, "I don't."
"Don't? Well, maybe you never noticed all the others did. I told them lots of things and they come true."
"What are you trying to say?"
"I had this here dream. I remember when it was because it was the same night Faye died."
Her eyes flicked up at Kate's cold face. She continued doggedly.
"It rained that night, and it was raining in my dream. Anyways, it was wet. Well, in my dream, I could see you come out the kitchen door. It wasn't pitch dark. Moon was coming through a little, and the dream thing was you. You went out to the back of the lot and stooped over. I couldn't see what you'd done. Then you come creeping back. Next thing I knew, why, Faye was dead."
She paused and waited for some comment from Kate, but Kate's face was expressionless. Ethel waited until she was sure Kate wouldn't speak.
"Well, like I said, I always believed in my dreams. It's funny, there wasn't nothing out there except some smashed medicine bottles and a little rubber tit from an eyedropper."
So Kate said lazily,
"So you took them to a doctor? What did he say had been in the bottles?" "Oh, I didn't do nothing like that."
"You should have," said Kate.
"I don't want to see nobody get in trouble. I've had enough trouble myself. I put that broke glass in an envelope and stuck it away."
Kate said softly, "And so you're coming to me for advice?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"I'll tell you what I think," said Kate. "I think you're a worn-out old whore, and you've been beaten over the head too many times."
"Don't you start saying I'm nuts," Ethel began.
"No, maybe you're not, but you're tired and you're sick. I told you I never let a friend down. You can come back here. You can't work, but you can help around, clean and give the cook a hand. You'll have a bed and you'll get your meals. How would that be? And a little spending money." Ethel stirred uneasily.
"No, ma'am," she said. "I don't think I want to sleep here. I don't carry that envelope around. I left it with a friend."
What did you have in mind? Kate asked.
Well, I thought if you could see your way to let me have $100 a month, why, I could make out and maybe get my health back.
You said you lived at the Southern Pacific Hotel?
Yes, ma'am. And my room is right up the hall from the desk. The night clerk's a friend of mine. He don't never sleep when he's on duty. Nice fella.
Kate said, don't wet your pants, Ethel. All you've got to worry about is how much does the nice fella cost. Now, wait a minute. She counted out 6 more $10 bills from the drawer in front of her and held them out.
Will it come the first of the month, or do I have to come here for it?
I'll send it to you, said Kate. And Ethel, she continued quietly, I still think you ought to have those bottles analyzed. Ethel clutched the money tightly in her hand. She was bubbling over with triumph and good feeling. It was one of the few things that had ever worked out for her.
I wouldn't think of doing that, she said. Not unless I had to.
After she had gone, Kate strolled out to the back of the lot behind the house. And even after years, she could see from the unevenness of the earth that it must have been pretty thoroughly dug over. The next morning, the judge heard the usual chronicle of small violence and nocturnal greed. He only half listened to the fourth case, and at the end of the terse testimony of the complaining witness, he asked,
How much did you lose?
The dark-haired man said,
Pretty close to $100.
The judge turned to the arresting officer.
How much did she have?
$96.
She got whiskey and cigarettes and some magazines from the night clerk at 6 o'clock this morning.
Ethel cried.
I never seen this guy in my life.
The judge looked up from his papers.
Twice for prostitution and now robbery. You're costing too much. I want you out of town by noon.
He turned to the officer.
Tell the sheriff to run her over the county line.
And he said to Ethel,
If you come back, I'll give you to the county for the limit. And that's San Quentin. Do you understand?
Ethel said,
Judge, I want to see you alone.
Why?
I got to see you, said Ethel. This is a frame.
Everything's a frame, said the judge. Next.
While the deputy sheriff drove Ethel to the county line on the bridge over the Pajaro River, the complaining witness strolled down Castroville Street toward Kate's, changed his mind, and went back to Kino's barbershop to get a haircut.
This ends Disc 17. East of Eden, Disc 18.
Ethel's visit didn't disturb Kate very much when it happened. She knew about what attention would be paid to a whore with a grievance, and that an analysis of the broken bottles wouldn't show anything recognizable as poison. She had nearly forgotten Faye. The forcible recalling was simply an unpleasant memory. Gradually, however, she found herself thinking about it. One night when she was checking the items on a grocery bill, a thought shot into her mind, shining and winking like a meteor. The thought flashed and went out so quickly that she had to stop what she was doing to try to find it. How was the dark face of Charles involved in the thought? And Sam Hamilton's puzzled and merry eyes? And why did she get a shiver of fear from the flashing thought? She gave it up and went back to her work, but the face of Charles was behind her, looking over her shoulder. Her fingers began to hurt her. She put the accounts away and made a tour through the house. It was a slow, listless night, a Tuesday night. There weren't even enough customers to put on the circus. Kate knew how the girls felt about her. They were desperately afraid of her. She kept them that way. It was probable that they hated her, but that didn't matter either. But they trusted her, and that did matter. If they followed the rules she laid down, followed them exactly, Kate would take care of them and protect them. There was no love involved and no respect. She never rewarded them, and she punished an offender only twice before she removed her. The girls did have the security of knowing that they wouldn't be punished without cause. As Kate walked about, the girls became elaborately casual. Kate knew about that, too, and expected it. But on this night, she felt that she wasn't alone. Charles seemed to walk to the side and behind her. She went through the dining room and into the kitchen, opened the icebox, and looked in. She lifted the cover of the garbage can and inspected it for waste. She did this every night, but this night she carried some extra charge. When she had left the parlor, the girls looked at each other and raised their shoulders in bewilderment. Eloise, who was talking to the dark-haired Joe, said, "Anything the matter?"
"Not that I know of. Why?"
"I don't know. She seems nervous."
"Well, there was some kind of rat race."
"What was it?"
"Wait a minute," said Joe. "I don't know, and you don't know."
"I get it. Mind my own business."
"You're goddamn right," said Joe. "Let's keep it that way, shall we?"
"I don't want to know," said Eloise.
"Now you're talking," Joe said.
Kate ranged back from her tour.
"I'm going to bed," she said to Joe. "Don't call me unless you have to."
"Anything I can do?"
"Yes, make me a pot of tea."
"Did you press that dress, Eloise?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"You didn't do it very well."
"Yes, ma'am."
Kate was restless. She put all of her papers neatly in the pigeonholes of her desk. And when Joe brought the tea tray, she had him put it beside her bed. Lying back among her pillows and sipping the tea, she probed for her thought. What about Charles? And then it came to her. Charles was clever. In his crazy way, Sam Hamilton was clever. That was the fear-driven thought. There were clever people. Both Sam and Charles were dead, but maybe there were others. She worked it out very slowly. Suppose I had been the one to dig up the bottles. What would I think, and what would I do? A rim of panic rose in her breast. Why were the bottles broken and buried? So it wasn't a poison. Then why bury them? What had made her do that? She should have dropped them in the gutter on Main Street or tossed them in the garbage can. Dr. Wilde was dead, but what kind of records did he keep? She didn't know. Suppose she had found the glass and learned what had been in them. Wouldn't she have asked someone who knew? Suppose you gave croton oil to a person, what would happen? Well, suppose you gave little doses and kept it up a long time. She would know. Maybe somebody else would know. Suppose you heard about a rich madam who willed everything to a new girl and then died. Kate knew perfectly well what her first thought would be. What insanity had made her get Ethel floated? Now she couldn't be found. Ethel should have been paid and tricked into turning over the glass. Where was the glass now? In an envelope, but where? How could Ethel be found? Ethel would know why and how she had been floated. Ethel wasn't bright, but she might tell somebody who was bright. That chattering voice might tell the story, how Faye was sick, and what she looked like, and about the will. Kate was breathing quickly, and little prickles of fear were beginning to course over her body. She should go to New York or someplace, not bother to sell the house. She didn't need the money. She had plenty. Nobody could find her. Yes, but if she ran out, and the clever person heard Ethel tell the story, wouldn't that cinch it? Kate got up from her bed and took a heavy dose of bromide. From that time on, the crouching fear had always been at her side. She was almost glad when she learned that the pain in her hands was developing arthritis. An evil voice had whispered that it might be a punishment. She had never gone out in the town very much, but now she developed a reluctance to go out at all. She knew that men stared secretly after her, knowing who she was. Suppose one of those men should have Charles' face or Samuel's eyes. She had to drive herself to go out once a week. Then she built the lean-to and had it painted gray. She said it was because the light troubled her eyes, and gradually she began to believe the light did trouble her eyes. Her eyes burned after a trip to the town. She spent more and more time in her little room. It is possible to some people, and it was possible for Kate, to hold two opposing thoughts at the same time. She believed that the light pained her eyes,
and also that the Grey Room